From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. Islamic State militants claim two bombings in the Arabian Peninsula on Friday targeting Shiite mosque, where at least 19 people died. VOA's Aru Pandey has U.S. reaction.
White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said Friday he could not corroborate Islamic State's claims it was responsible for the blast.
The attribution, the determination about who is responsible, is something that is still under review.
The claim of responsibility for the mosque attack in Saudi Arabia and for one in Yemen comes on the heels of Islamic State's seizure of Ramadi. And in neighboring Syria, the fall of the ancient city of Palmyra to IS militants. Despite the taking of territory, the White House has stood firm this week, announcing no changes in its strategy against the militant group, which is comprised of thousands of U.S.-led coalition airstrikes to back Iraqi forces on the ground. Aru Pandey, The White House.
Visiting one of Washington's largest synagogues on Friday, President Obama reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to Israel's security and stressed that Iran must not, in his words, under any circumstance, be allowed to get a nuclear weapon.
I'm interested in a deal that blocks every single one of Iran's pathways to a nuclear weapon, every single path. A deal that imposes unprecedented inspections on all elements of Iran's nuclear program so that they can't cheat.
Negotiators from Iran and a group that includes Britain, China, France, Russia, the United States, and Germany have been working against a June 30th deadline for a final nuclear deal to scale back Iran's nuclear program, that in exchange for sanctions release. This is VOA News. U.S. and Cuban officials meeting in Washington have failed to reach an overall agreement on reopening embassies and fully reestablishing diplomatic relations after a break of more than 50 years. The State Department's Roberta Jacobson said she remained optimistic that negotiations will conclude, that the two sides still have a few things that need to be ironed out.
This round of talks was highly productive. We will persist, inspired by the conviction that engagement and not isolation are the keys to moving forward.
This week's talks were the first high-level engagement between the two countries since President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro met during the April Summit of the Americas in Panama. Still on the agenda here in Washington is President Obama's intention to remove Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Amnesty International says it has overwhelming evidence that Ukrainian government forces, pro-government militias, and anti-government separatists are still committing what they call ongoing war crimes, such as torture and summary killings of prisoners. Concern about prisoner mistreatment comes amid criticism of Ukraine's security services for publicly showing off two prisoners alleged to be Russian soldiers captured while fighting alongside pro-Russia separatists in eastern Ukraine. Amnesty called on Ukrainian authorities to investigate all allegations of war crimes and other abuses and bring to justice those responsible. United Nations Humanitarian Affairs Office reports that nearly 30,000 people have fled intensified fighting in northern Mali over the past 2 weeks. Lisa Schlein has more from the UN in Geneva.
Sporadic fighting is a way of life in Mali's turbulent northern region, but the United Nations is alarmed at the recent increase in violence in small villages surrounding the city of Timbuktu. A spokesman for the UN's humanitarian office, Jens Laerke, says,
"Our partners and local authorities on the ground estimate that over the past 2 weeks, nearly 27,000 people have fled their homes and villages. In the past week alone, 20,000 people have been uprooted by this violence. They are in urgent need of water, food, non-food items, and emergency shelter."
Tuareg separatist rebels have been fighting for an independent state for Mali for decades. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Attackers in Burundi's capital have thrown grenades into a crowded marketplace, killing at least two people. The latest violence sparked by President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid for another term in office. President's decision triggered a failed coup and sent more than 100,000 people fleeing the country. In another development on Friday, the UN Refugee Agency says an outbreak of cholera has killed 29 refugees from Burundi.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show today are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington Columnist for The Economist. Here are the issues. In a matter of days, Islamic State, the extremist group, captured Ramadi in Iraq and Palmyra in Syria, a city with 2,000-year-old archaeological treasures. In Washington, hundreds of documents taken from Osama bin Laden's residence in Pakistan were released publicly. Meanwhile, Bill and Hillary Clinton in 2014 earned $26 million in speeches, money donated to their foundation. Barbara, let's start with what I think most people think are significant losses in Iraq and Syria, yet the Obama administration says, no, we're not losing this war.
Well, President Obama called these the losses a setback, which I guess is a good euphemism for what was obviously a disastrous bunch of days. Mm-hmm. You know, the administration line is that Islamic State has been contained, that they're being slowly pushed back, that the administration has a strategy for dealing with this group. But obviously, the Islamic State has its own strategy, and they are very successful still in Sunni Muslim areas of Iraq, like Ramadi, where they had controlled part of the city for quite a long time, but they were able to take over the rest of it using suicide bombers, apparently 30 suicide bombs that combined with a sandstorm that kept Americans from bombing the place, sapped the morale of the Iraqi forces there and led them to an orderly retreat. Now, this is the other thing the administration is saying. The outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey, says they drove out. They were not driven out. Well, I think that's small comfort to the Iraqi government. In Syria, you have another kind of dynamic. You have Palmyra in the desert, where government forces were not present in large numbers. It was apparently an easy win for the Islamic State, as you point out. They now could destroy, loot, sell one of the most precious archaeological sites in the world. I had the good fortune to actually go there in 1999 and see it. So, you know, I count myself among the lucky few, because there may be many who don't have that possibility in the future.
Well, what do you say, David?
Well, Fred, the question that you asked Barbara just now was, how can the Americans say we are not losing this war? Mm-hmm. I suspect, in fact, I know, because I spent the week talking to senior administration officials about this stuff, they would challenge the premise of your question. They would say, why is it America that is losing or winning this war? This is not America's war. And that's a very important point. I mean, it may be that the rest of the world says the rise of ISIS is directly due to things that previous American governments did, like invade Iraq. But fundamentally, Barack Obama does not believe that America's job is to defeat ISIS. He believes that it is for the Sunni Muslims on the ground to defeat their extremist Sunni cousins, and that it is only the Iraqi government and the tribes that can do this job. And I think he would contest the idea that America fails when ISIS wins. Now, that's being clever
here.
Well, that's
a fine point.
That's being clever here because, you know, America
is... I call
that
an excuse.
Well, it's not black and white, is it? I mean, I think, you know, it is the case that it is not American ground troops are not going to go in and fight a war with 200,000, 300,000 American ground troops to sort this out. This is going to have to be a conflict in the region. It's also the case that, you know, when bad things happen somewhere in the world, it is not automatically the fault of the American president that those bad things are happening.
That's true.
But it is also the case, clearly, that America has more ability than anyone else to supply arms and training and to put its thumb on the scales if it says it sees an interest in ISIS losing. And there you can see, at the very least, a lack of a very clear strategy. There's lots of American promises and explanations about why it would be a good thing to train more and to provide more arms. And even those promises and sort of plans don't seem to be happening. That's clearly legitimate.
Okay, I'll rephrase taking your complaint into under advisement. I'll rephrase the question. Is ISIS winning?
Well, I mean, so someone I was talking to this week who has up-to-date live intelligence from the battlefield inside the government here was full of kind of interesting excuses. So Ramadi was a tactical setback. They talked, as Barbara said, about the sandstorm. They talked about the fact that the Iraqi army forces near Ramadi had not been resupplied properly by the government and headquarters, so they were in a kind of demoralized, exhausted state. There's even talk about how people were distracted by the need to protect some pilgrimages, and ISIS was opportunistic. It's pretty skilled at seizing its moment. On the other hand, they say if you look at some of the stuff happening in Syria, we should give more credit to the Kurdish fighters up near the Syria-Turkish border who are apparently having some successes. The Americans point to those. They point to the success of the Kurdish fighters in the northern areas of Kurdistan in Iraq. So they try and say, you know, ISIS is winning some, losing some. It's a fluid situation. They're very opportunistic. But there are some, you know, there are some good things happening. I think the big picture is we can all agree that there isn't a clear plan for achieving the ambition of destroying ISIS.
Yeah, Barbara, you can respond to that, but also I still don't understand how ISIS, with, what, roughly 20,000 troops, has been so successful against Iraqi militia, the Iraqi army, which doesn't seem to much, some Americans, anyway.
You put your finger on something. I mean, part of the problem, certainly, well, it's true in both Syria and Iraq, in terms of confusion about who's our friend and who the United States wants to be involved. There was a battle for Tikrit, which was being led by Shia militias that are close to Iran. And they got bogged down. They weren't able to complete the fight. And the United States told the Iraqi government that you get those militias out of the way, you bring in, you know, forces that are under your control, and we will provide air support, and we will help you win this battle. And that's what the U.S. did. So that's sort of the model now for how the United States is supposed to operate. But it didn't work in Tikrit. The Iraqi troops left, and the militias had not been mobilized to come and take their place. So we have this huge problem where sometimes it's okay for the Shiite militias to take part, sometimes it's not. The United States is terrified that this will alienate the Sunnis even more in Iraq. Meanwhile, the Iraqi parliament has yet to pass a law that would allow formation of National Guard units, localized National Guard units, which in the case of Anbar province, Ramadi is the capital of Anbar province, would be Sunni National Guardsmen. So that force has not yet been stood up. So there's, for now, the U.S. and the Iraqi government really does still have to rely to a great extent on these Shia militias. And that's an uncomfortable fact that makes winning the broader war even harder.
It's time now for a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and David Rennie. And isn't it true that it is very difficult to get Sunnis who live in Anbar province to fight ISIS, who are also Sunnis?
Yeah, absolutely. When their concern is that all they're doing is strengthening a Shiite government in Baghdad that is supported by Iran. You know, that's why Iraq may not hold together as a country, ultimately. And I think we go back to David's point, which is that the United States can try to help the government in Baghdad and to somehow, you know, after all the blood, sweat, tears that the U.S. has poured into this country over the years, try to keep something standing there. But ultimately, American soldiers are not going back to fight and die for Ramadi again.
And I think there's a really important point here, which is, you know, people outside the United States, I think, need to understand public opinion, even the mood inside Congress. This is not the America of 10 years ago, where lots of members of Congress and lots of Americans, particularly conservative Americans, had big ambitions to reshape the Middle East, to make countries in the Middle East more like Western democracies. You can criticize the Obama administration, and should, for a lack of a clear strategy. But the truth is, I don't think American public opinion really knows what it wants either. You know, basically, most Americans were galvanized by the sight of ISIS extremists cutting the heads of Americans off last year. Up until that point, American TV news pictures of horrendous civilian losses in Syria and terrible scenes in the Civil War basically, I'm afraid, left Americans cold, because Americans are done with trying to fix the Middle East. They have very, very low expectations about how much America can do to make these into nice, friendly countries. They're very cynical about what is seen here as a lack of gratitude in the Muslim world for everything America has done. That maybe that's seen completely differently in the Muslim world. But Americans basically, I think, have very low ambitions. And basically what they want is to stop ISIS from threatening America and to stop them cutting the heads off Americans. But that's kind of it. The neocons that people will remember from 10 years ago, they're done. They are just not a force. There isn't a kind of remake and bring democracy to the Middle East party in this town.
You know, the suggestions to reform or rebuild or strengthen the policy in Iraq now, I think suggests that with 10,000 more troops on top of the 3,000 that are already there, with the new troops being allowed to be a part of Iraqi militia units, the chances of success would be much greater.
You know,
I happen to think that Americans would support that, not a huge influx of troops as we had back 10 years ago.
They would, but I think also people are concerned about mission creep and people are concerned about, you know, we've heard this story before and then they end up being more than advisors and they end up, you know, staying longer. And then you've got this very odd kind of parallel debate here, which is a debate about President Obama, which is dressed up as a debate about the Middle Eastern policy. But fundamentally, by far the most potent, powerful lines for President Obama's critics in this town is just say, the reason the world looks like a terrible mess is because President Obama is a feckless, weak leader who doesn't believe in America's kind of moral forces, a sort of shining city on a hill. And it sounds like a debate about the Middle East, but it isn't really. It's a political argument about whether Barack Obama loves America enough. And I think the number of people in this town really with concrete ideas as to how to make the Middle East better is a depressingly small number.
Yeah, Barbara, do you agree with that? I don't, but I'll let you
respond.
Well,
I think that's part of it. But, you know, I also know a lot of people who like President Obama who were just very concerned, for example, that the U.S. missed an opportunity in Syria 3 years ago to strengthen moderate opposition forces. And there was a very interesting report from the Defense Intelligence Agency from 2012 that was declassified a couple of days ago that actually predicted everything that we've seen. It predicted the rise of what was then al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was the precursor of the Islamic State, predicted that it would return to its old pockets in Mosul and Ramadi and declare an Islamic State through union with other terrorist organizations in Iraq and Syria. That was in 2012. This prediction was made. So the intelligence community knew what was happening. Now the question is, could the United States have done anything at that time that would have prevented this? You know, I think Obama was never going to get American troops heavily involved, but there is an argument, and it will continue, over whether more support for the so-called moderates and, you know, a no-fly zone in Syria might have changed the dynamic at that time.
I totally agree with Barbara. Two things. I totally agree that you should criticize President Obama for messing up Syria policy. I think there is a completely legitimate kind of debate and among the foreign policy establishment and the think tanks and the elite kind of bubble in Washington. That debate is there. I guess what I'm trying to explain to listeners outside America is the nation, the bigger public opinion and the bigger political debate, to an extent that I find depressing, isn't really a debate about how can America, the last superpower, you know, fix the Middle East. That's just not where American politics is right now.
Let me, you all have mentioned President Obama. Here's what he said on December 14th, 2011, this was just before the final American troops were taken out of Iraq. He said, "We are leaving behind a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq with a representative government that was elected by its people." He called it a moment of success. Having said that, what responsibility does the United States, whether President Obama or his administration or just the country as a whole, bear for what's happened in Iraq now?
I think a lot. Clearly huge. But, okay. I mean, you have to also be reasonable and bipartisan in your criticism that there's another administration that also bears responsibility for what's happening in Iraq.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's called the George W. Bush administration.
George W. Bush administration.
But was President Obama wrong when he said that in 2011?
President Obama was being a politician. He had won election handsomely by promising to leave Iraq. He was making a ridiculously positive case for what he was leaving behind because his primary political impulse was to leave. And let's not forget, he was cheered to the rafters by the American people for leaving. And he was putting a sort of a ridiculously optimistic spin on the departure.
Yeah, and Fred, he was elected to get out of Iraq.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't elected necessarily to get out even the residual force that his administration had and earlier administrations had said they wanted to have there. So,
I mean, the reason that there wasn't a residual force was partly he didn't want to, and partly because the Iraqi parliament, let's not forget, was was not willing to let them stay.
All right, we'll be back in just a minute.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
We're back. I'm with Barbara Slavin and David Rennie. Palmyra, you've corrected me on that nicely. What about it? Why is it so important, other than all the great archaeological treasures?
Well, yeah, there's magnificent colonnade. There's an entire Roman city there that is, you know, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, all the rest of that. But it's also, the modern city is Tadmor, and there's an airbase there, and there's a highway that runs through it. It's sort of central in Syria, and from there you can go north to Aleppo, you can go west to the coast, you can go down to Damascus, and it's this highway apparently that leads also to the Assad regime's last holdout in the east of Syria, a place called Deir ez-Zor. So without access to the highway, they'll have trouble resupplying troops there, and Deir ez-Zor is likely to fall as well, and this will allow the Islamic State to consolidate this huge hunk of mostly desert, but you know, almost half of Syria, and then a big chunk of Iraq as well. So it's access to the highway. It also sits very close to Syrian natural gas deposits and pipelines, which will be another source of revenue, which means they can pay more foreign fighters.
Does this really, the capture of Palmyra, is this a tipping point against the Assad regime?
I don't know. I mean, that's the bigger question, because at the same time the Islamic State is gaining strength, of course, the Assad regime is losing strength. It's hollowing out. And, you know, the real question is, does the international community have anything to replace the Assad regime if somebody, you know, puts a bullet through his brain? Mm-hmm. And I hope that people are thinking about that now.
All right, the bin Laden documents, hundreds were released, David. I think there are many hundreds of thousands more, but anyway, hundreds were released. One thing I think that we learned from it is that Osama bin Laden, even in his hideaway in Pakistan, was still really in charge of al-Qaeda.
Yeah, and there was, you know, occasionally sort of looks like the kind of CEO of a multinational, kind of grumbling about, you know, various kind of regional affiliates.
Yes.
and management sort of issues that he was trying to face. But at the same time, if you look at his bookshelf and you assume that most of the things on his bookshelf belong to him, he was also someone who was at once surprisingly in touch with what was going on and getting, you know, up-to-date information and reading Western media sources. Not The Economist, which The Economist is quite relieved about, I think. But at the same time, completely detached from reality. I mean, he had on his bookshelf, and this is one of the weirdest things, a few books which suggested that 9/11 was a conspiracy cooked up by the Americans, cooked up by the Israelis, these very, very outlandish conspiracy books. You would have thought that he wasn't in the market for those. I mean, he kind of knew that 9/11 was him. So, but somehow, you know, I think this shows what a strange kind of bubble of weirdness he lived in. Mm-hmm. He was up for a bit of a conspiracy theory about who did 9/11.
Yeah, Barbara, what do you make of these documents?
Yeah, well, I see the more human side of, mm-hmm. of him. I mean, he was missing his third wife, who apparently... And a son who had found refuge in Iran, and he wanted them back with him. And so he wrote letters to her saying, you know, I'm going to have to leave Abbottabad. I'm going to have to find another place so we can all be together. I mean, you get a sense of somebody who, he was the leader of this terrorist organization, but also a human being, mm-hmm. who wanted his family around him and who was, in a sense, a captive of his own making in this compound where he had two Pakistanis who made sure he did not go out.
Was there any indication from these limited documents that al-Qaeda was in decline, Barbara?
You know, I think there were earlier documents that were released that suggested some frustration about an inability to pull off other major attacks, and also documents I remember that were released a couple years ago that showed differences with Iran. which, you know, a very uneasy relationship with the Iranians who were holding on to his wife, some others, one of his sons, you know, as essentially captives there for leverage against Iran. And, you know, we've seen glimmers of his management of international relations before. But I would agree that the bookshelf was perhaps the most interesting part.
I mean, actually, some of the most interesting documents were the ones released earlier where he was talking to the people who were essentially the founders of ISIS. Hmm. And he was telling them to cut it out. You know, he and some of his deputies were saying to them, will you stop cutting people's heads off on video? You know, this is not winning us any allies here. You know, cut it out. Don't do that. You know, kill them some other way. Or particularly interesting, Al-Qaeda leadership telling the sort of embryonic leadership of ISIS, don't declare an Islamic caliphate. Don't declare an Islamic state. It's too soon. You know, consolidate a bit. Don't do this stuff. So, you know, we're not going to dress up Osama bin Laden as this kind of lovelorn management guy, kind of, you know, tearing his hair out about the young terrorists. He was a psychotic, and if he missed his family, there's plenty of other families who missed their families because he killed them.
But it appears from that he was politically astute.
He was less crazy than ISIS. Okay. I think that we can say with some confidence.
That's one way of putting it. Barbara, we're going to turn to the Clintons here, Bill and Hillary, earning $26 million in speeches in was that, I think I said 2014, but this year, I think.
No, I think it's over a slightly longer
period.
Well,
whatever it is,
It's over a slightly longer period. But it's part of this whole controversy over how much money, you know, the Clinton family has brought in for themselves personally and for the foundation. This particular trove was not earlier declared because it was just donated to the foundation, and so it was counted as revenue, not as donations. But when you look at where the money comes from for the speeches, I think that's what worries you. There was a Nigerian newspaper group that gave $500,000 for a speech by Bill Clinton, a Chinese holding company, another $500,000 to Bill Clinton. Citibank paid $250,000 for Hillary to give a speech. A foundation in Mexico run by the gazillionaire Carlos Slim gave $250,000 to Hillary. And you have to ask yourself, you know, is there going to be, if Hillary becomes president, any sort of residual gratitude toward countries, toward, you know, companies, because of the largesse that they showed the Clinton Foundation? And, you know, the Clinton family will argue, no, all this money went for, you know, wonderful causes, treating HIV/AIDS, you know, helping children, all the rest. But is it just the way the world works now? I don't know.
I think the problem is that it is the way the world works for people who have been senior politicians and then retire. And there's a money door. You walk through the money door from the White House into the world of ex-presidents or ex-prime ministers like Tony Blair of the UK. You go through the money door, and then everyone kind of understands a bit queasily that you will live this strange life, sort of flying on other people's private jets to conferences on mountaintops and giving, you know, anodyne speeches about the 21st century and getting paid $500,000 for your anodyne speech. The problem that Hillary Clinton has, I think, is that she is trying something very unusual, which is to come the wrong way through the money door. That money door, I think, is a one-way money door for most people. We just about understand that people like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and maybe in the future Barack Obama will walk through that door and they'll go into this slightly strange life. She walked through that door with Bill, and she's now trying to come back and become a public servant again. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem. We're in uncharted waters here.
Well, then there's the problem of whether the foundation has disclosed all the money that's come in and whether that fit with the State Department agreement and so on. It's a complicated issue that doesn't seem to go away, but we are going to go away because that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.